trending toward uncontrolled escalation. Mourners in the occupied West Bank call for justice following the assassination of a senior resistance fighter by Israel. In the race to succeed British Prime Minister Liz Truss heats up as senior Conservatives warn against the return of Boris Johnson to power. Thanks for joining us. Russia's defense minister is warning that the situation in Ukraine is rapidly spiraling out of control. Sergei Shoigu made the warning in a phone call with the French defense minister. He also conveyed Moscow's concerns that Ukraine could use a dirty bomb in the conflict. The so-called dirty bomb uses conventional explosives laced with radioactive material. Shoigu repeated the claim in separate phone calls with his British and Turkish counterparts. The Russian defense minister also discussed the situation in Ukraine in a rare phone call with the U.S. defense secretary on Friday. In the latest major development on the ground, the Russian military says it has destroyed a depot in central Ukraine that was storing over 100,000 tons of aviation fuel. From Donetsk, our correspondent Johnny Miller gives us the latest about the front line, as well as the propaganda and psychological warfare going on in Ukraine.
Yes, one Ukrainian official said the attacks yesterday by Russia were as bad as the strikes on the 10th and 11th of October. That's when, of course, Russia started hitting these energy, this energy infrastructure. It's interesting that we're not really seeing any pictures of the damage of these strikes. The reason for that is that the Ukrainian government has demanded that its citizens don't post videos of Russian strikes. Of course, many of the videos we see are just of ordinary people getting out their phones and filming the damage. But we're not seeing that now, as there's an attempt by the Ukrainian government to stop any panic that arises from these strikes. There's also a bit of a propaganda war, as they say that their air defense is working. It's not clear how well it is working. Russia says that it's hitting its targets every day. And as you were saying, there's around 40% of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has already been destroyed. In terms of the battle at the front lines, the major focus right now is on Kherson. Ukraine has been building up forces north of Kherson. Russia is evacuating tens of thousands of civilians. They're doing this for three reasons. One, to stop pro-Russian civilians falling into Ukrainian hands. Secondly, to save civilian lives from Ukrainian strikes against the city of Kherson. And thirdly, to help Russia itself have a better operational maneuverability on the battlefield to enable them to use heavy weapons themselves and set up defensive positions without killing civilians as well. And finally, where I am on the Donbass front, far to the north east of Kherson, the front line's only about 5 kilometers from where I am now. Russia is trying to take advantage of Ukraine mobilizing in Kherson to make advances themselves in the Donbass, and they are making some slow, tentative advances near where I am now. Taking the rest of the Donbass and holding on to Kherson, very much the primary objectives of Russia right now.
Palestinians have held a funeral for a resistance fighter who was assassinated by the Israeli regime early this morning. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for his crimes and called for justice. The victim, identified as Tamer Al-Kilani, was killed in a bomb explosion in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. He was a member of Erin al-Usud resistance group, which is now warning of a harsh response. Hamas has also said that the crime will not go unanswered. And the Islamic Jihad has reacted by saying that the assassination will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to fight on. Tensions have intensified in the occupied West Bank. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers shot and wounded a 16-year-old Palestinian in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds, claiming that he had injured an Israeli man in a stabbing attack. The correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Tamer Al-Kilani was a senior member of a newly formed Palestinian resistance group.
What happened is that according to the newly formed Palestinian group, Lion's Den, Tamer Al-Kilani, a senior member of the Lion's Den group, had been assassinated in Nablus when an explosion, let's say, or an explosive device attached to a motorcycle detonated in Nablus Old City, and he was passing by this motorcycle, and he was killed. As you have mentioned, a Palestinian had been killed by the Israeli forces in Palestine last night, when, according to the Israeli military, this Palestinian man, Rabi al-Rabi, tried to enter the lands occupied in 1948. This is the Israeli story, near the separation wall, and they opened fire at his vehicle, killing him last night.
The series of events have taken place recently involving Palestinian resistance groups, in particular Hamas and the Fatah Party. First, their reconciliation, and then Hamas's rapprochement with Syria. This later development was seen as a major breakthrough, so much so that it caught the attention of the U.S., which said that the move would undermine the Palestinian cause and hurt Palestinians as a result. Washington's stance comes as a surprise, given how it has done nothing for Palestinians except backing a regime that violates their rights, namely Israel. The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League. In order to understand the resistance groups' movements, in particular Hamas, it's a good idea to review what has occurred. Initially, there was the reconciliation among Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian factions in Algiers. Then there was the meeting between Hamas and Lebanon's President Michel Aoun. Also, Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh visited Moscow recently and met with Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. And finally, Hamas's reconciliation with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. These developments could all hint at the strengthening of the resistance front. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union.
but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians, instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
Welcome back. The former British Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now in the race for Conservative Party leadership and premiership, as senior members are pushing to prevent a comeback by the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Sunak coupled his announcement with a pledge to fix the economy. His supporters are warning that Johnson's return will worsen the UK's economic turmoil. They're planning to secure an overwhelming support that would force Johnson to abandon the race. The former Premier has until Monday to announce his candidacy, but he's still short 45 MPs. Britain is reeling from rising inflation and economic crisis. This has been worsened by an ill-advised tax plan by the outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss. She was forced to announce her resignation on Friday, after just 6 weeks in office. Earlier we asked economist and author Steve Keane if either Sunak or Johnson is capable of sorting out the UK's economic troubles.
No, and not on the Labour side either. One of the great difficulties of watching this debacle is the knowledge that the position that all of them have on government spending, that they're believing the government borrows from the public and therefore that has to be restrained, otherwise it'll be a burden on the economy and the public, is completely wrong in accounting terms. And so the whole obsession with reducing the budget deficit is actually trying to reduce the amount of money the government creates and leave it all to the private sector, which has done such a fantastic job, of course, since 2008. So it's all driven by a distorted interpretation of what the government should be doing. No one stands out. What is really going on here is the absurdity of the five-year fixed term that the Parliament has in the UK. If this had been a three-year term, none of this farce would be taking place, because whoever was the leader would already have been turfed out by the electorate. And I get the feeling there's a very strong desire by the electorate right now to turf out the Tories and let somebody else get in there, whether they know what they're doing or not.
Thousands of people have held a rally in the Spanish capital, Madrid, to protest rising inflation. Demonstrators held signs and chanted slogans. They want their pensions to rise in line with the country's consumer prices. Protesters are also demanding better salaries. The protest comes as the cost of living in Spain has increased by nearly 9% in October. The Spanish government has introduced two extraordinary packages over the past few months that have subsidized petrol and public transport, among other things. However, protesters say it's not enough. Food, fuel, rent, and home heating prices have been spiraling upwards in Europe as the continent is bracing for the worst to come for winter. Xi Jinping will be the leader of China for another 5 years, after the Communist Congress Party confirms his status. President Xi was picked as the party's general secretary for a third time in a closed-door vote. That means that he will be elected president at the annual meeting of National People's Congress in March. The new lineup of the party's seven-member standing committee, over which Xi presides, was also announced. Speaking to the media at the event, President Xi said that China will open its doors to the world even wider in the new era. He noted that the country is on the path to modernization and will move towards securing better prosperity for its people. During its week-long gathering, the Congress approved the addition of new wording to the party charter, elevating Xi's core status. Independent China specialist Andrew Leung says that Xi Jinping is facing both domestic and global challenges during his third term in office.
Domestically, I think President Xi is known to have mentioned a number of traps for the nation. The first trap he mentioned was in the, 2018 Party Congress. He referred to the Tacitus trap, T-A-C-I-T-U-S, the name after the Roman emperor. Tacitus trap means if other countries do not believe in the Communist Party, for example, then whatever the Communist Party does would be seen negatively. The second trap, as everybody is familiar with, is the Thucydides trap, rivalry between the world's two great superpowers. And the third trap is the middle-income trap, which entrapped a number of developing countries for a long, long time in middle income without rising to higher levels of development. The fourth trap is what Professor Joseph Dye of Harvard Kennedy School refers to the as the Kindleberger trap. That is, even a country reaches the top of the world superpower, it's questionable whether that country can deliver in terms of global governance. As, for example, the ability of the United States at the moment to be able to maintain global stability is in doubt.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A German think tank has warned that Europe's largest economy will face a recession next year, and a reduction in Russian energy supply will increase inflationary problems in Germany. The Institute of Economic Research, a German think tank, warned that the German economy is expected to shrink by 0.3% in 2023. The cut in the supply of gas from Russia in the summer and the significant increase in the price of this product harmed the recovery of Germany's economy after the coronavirus pandemic. Also, the real income of German households and purchasing power in this country will be greatly reduced. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian writes, last week, the Munich-based Institute of Economic Research slashed its prognosis for German economic growth, declaring the country is heading into a winter recession. It forecasts Europe's largest economy would shrink by 0.3% in 2023, after growing by just 1.6% this year. Inflation is forecast to hit 8.1% this year, and 9.3% in 2023. Timo Wolmershauser, the Institute of Economic Research's head of forecasts, said, the cuts to gas supplies from Russia this summer and the drastic price increases they triggered are wreaking havoc on Germany's economic recovery following the coronavirus pandemic. Timo Wolmershauser added, he did not expect a return to normal until 2024, when 1.8% economic growth and 2.4% inflation could be expected. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is travelling to the Persian Gulf in the coming days to secure supplies of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from United Arab Emirates, as Russia chokes off its gas supply to Germany. A recent survey has shown consumer confidence to be at its lowest level since the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1949. Faced with higher energy bills, German households are rethinking spending, from holidays to household purchases and meals out. Businesses are doing the same, avoiding new investments and instead holding crisis meetings about how low they can reduce heating in factories and offices. Increasing number of companies are switching their workers into Kurzarbeit, short-time working mode, which was first introduced in the 1920s in response to the economic crisis in the Weimar Republic, and later utilized to considerable effect during the global financial crisis. This willingness to cling on to workers is seen as crucial if Germany stands a chance of emerging from the current crisis. But increasingly, the question is being asked: how long will it be able to afford to do so? The website Politico explains more about the same story. Germany's Bundesbank said in its monthly report on Monday, 19th of September, that Germany is heading into recession as inflation is set to top the 10% mark. The report said there are mounting signs of a recession in the German economy in the sense of a clear, broad-based and prolonged decline in economic output. The central bank projects a moderate contraction for the current quarter and more pronounced declines in activity in the final quarter of this year and the first quarter of next year. The Bundesbank, the German central bank, said high inflation and uncertainty with regard to energy supply and its cost affect not only the gas and electricity intensive industry and its export business and investments, but also private consumption and the service providers dependent on it. The Bundesbank did not offer any specific numbers and cautioned that the outlook for the Eurozone's largest economy remains shrouded in uncertainty. The industry-heavy German economy is very reliant on Russian gas, making it particularly vulnerable to the fallout from the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. At the same time, the report said inflation is seen accelerating further and coming in at double digits in the coming months. The British newspaper The Financial Times sheds more light on the same issue. Investors are now more pessimistic about the German economy than they have been at any time since the Eurozone debt crisis more than a decade ago, worrying that a sharp fall in Russian natural gas supplies and soaring energy prices will plunge the country into recession. The ZEW Institute's gauge of investor expectations about Europe's largest economy has sunk to its lowest level since 2011, dropping from -53.8 to -55.3, underlining the deepening gloom about the economic fallout from Russia's special operation in Ukraine. Economists have slashed their estimates for economic growth in Germany and the wider Eurozone this year, while raising their inflation forecasts and warning that an end to Russia energy supplies would force Berlin to ration gas supplies for heavy industrial users. According to the European Energy Exchange, German baseload power for delivery next year, the benchmark European price, rose over 5% to a record €502 per megawatt hour. This is six times higher than the price a year ago, driven upwards by the sharply higher cost of gas used to generate electricity and a prolonged European heatwave that has disrupted generating capacity in Europe. According to data from Eurostat, the European Commission Statistics Bureau, the surging price of energy has driven up the cost of imports for Germany and other Eurozone countries, sending the bloc's trade deficit up to 24.6 billion euros in June, compared with a surplus of 17.2 billion euros for the same month a year earlier. The value of exports from the bloc rose 20.1% in June from a year ago, but imports were up 43.5%. Michael Schroeder, a researcher at the ZEW, said the still high increase in consumer prices and the expected additional costs for heating and electricity are currently having a particularly negative impact on the prospects for the consumer-related sectors of the German economy. Michael Schroeder said investor sentiment also worsened due to the expected tightening of financing conditions after the European Central Bank, the ECB, raised its deposit rate by 0.5 percentage points to zero in response to record levels of Eurozone inflation. Carsten Brzeski, head of the macro research at Dutch Bank ING, said the German economy was quickly approaching a perfect storm caused by high inflation, possible energy supply disruptions, and ongoing supply frictions.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
ذاق طعم عذابها بمعصيته وحبس بين أطباقها بجرمه وجريرته وهو يضج إليك ضجيج مؤمل لرحمتك ويناديك بلسان أهل توحيدك ويتوسل إليك بربوبيتك
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this part of the Kumail supplication, in which Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the believers, states, أَفَتُرَاكَ سُبْحَانَكَ يَا إِلَهِ وَبِحَمْدِكَ تَسْمَعُ فِيهَا صَوْتَ عَبْدٍ مُسْلِمٍ سُجِنَ فِيهَا بِمُخَالَفَتِهِ Can't you see yourself, glory be to you, my Allah, and yours is the praise, hearing within the fire, the voice of a slave surrendered to you, imprisoned there because of his violations. وَذَاقَ طَعْمَ عَذَابِهَا بِمَعْصِيَتِهِ He is suffering its torment because of his disobedience. حُبِسَ بَيْنَ أَطْبَاقِهَا بِجُرْمِهِ وَجَرِيرَتِهِ He is confined within its levels because of his sin and his crimes. وَهُوَ يَلِجُّ إِلَيْكَ ضَجِيجَ مُؤَمِّلٍ لِرَحْمَتِكَ Yet, He is lamenting before you with the lament of the one hopeful for your mercy. As you may remember, In the previous episode, we said that Imam Ali alayhi salam is explicitly saying that the reason this man is confined within the different levels of hellfire is because of his sins and crimes. Yet, he is hopeful of Almighty Allah's mercy. Now, since we were looking at the different etiquettes and prerequisites of acceptance of supplication and dua while we were having a discussion over different parts of Kumail supplication, we tried to have a look at the role of sins in the acceptance of supplications. In the previous episode, We concluded that there are some obstacles and impediments which prevent a prayer from ascending to Allah. And the role of sins is that they veil man from Allah. They have two important roles. The first is that they take away man from Allah, they cut him off from him. And the second is that they prevent the prayer from ascending to Allah. Now, in order to clarify and elaborate on that, we need a short introduction. We know the importance of soul and qalb, that is a kind of connecting device that receives from Allah, and on the other hand, it gives out. It has a twofold function. The guidance and light is specific to the hearts of the believers based on the Holy Quran, and of course the muttaqin, the pious ones, because they receive it, because they interact with this light. Now, in the second aspect, the heart plays the role of disseminating the light and the guidance it has received. Allah the Exalted says, "And the one whom Allah has not granted any light has no light." So, the role of the heart in the process of receiving, giving out guidance is kind of arbitrary. It receives this light from Allah and then directs with it man's power of sight, hearing, and the rest of his organs. Now, if you want to know how the heart becomes somehow like a stone that cannot receive any light, air, or water, you need to look at the importance of the role of sins in somehow changing the functions of the heart. We'll elaborate more after a short break.
My Lord, glory and praise be to you. Would you disregard the voice of a Muslim slave imprisoned in hell for his disobedience and imprisoned within its pits for his evil doings and misdeeds, crying out to you the cries of one who has faith in your mercy and calling out to you in the language of those who believe in your unity and seeking to approach you by means of your epithet.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Dear listeners, we know that when the Holy Quran says, deaf, dumb, and blind, they will not come back to the right path. We know that a deaf and blind person is not able to receive any calls or light. This means his heart is somehow useless. And this is the importance of heart. Mentioning one of the characteristics of the Holy Quran, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "The book of Allah by which you see, speak, and listen." So, if the soundness of the heart is lost, it would be devoid of any power to receive the divine light. So, the owner of the heart would be unable to receive the descending Quran from Allah. Now, the role of the sins is that they cause the death of the heart. This is the key sentence. Allah says, "Indeed, you cannot make the dead hear, nor can you make the deaf hear the call." So, when some people are calling the Almighty Allah and they are not responded to, when they are imprisoned in the hellfire, حُبِسَ بَيْنَ أَطْبَاقِهَا بِجُرْمِهِ وَجَرِيرَتِهِ, is because of their sins. The flaw is not in the strength of the call. The flaw is not in its delivery. It is in the ability of the dead to hear. It is in the ability of this supplication to ascend. And this is exactly the state of the obscurity of the heart and its disconnection from Allah the Exalted. These sins committed by mankind cause the heart to be disconnected from the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is taking long and rapid strides in the fields of science and technology. This is an undeniable fact and cannot be ignored even by Western journals, which rarely cover the achievements of Iran. Science Journal has recently published an article on Iran's world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope. Science describes the Iranian achievement in this way. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers have announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year, is operational and has acquired its debut images. Stay tuned to know more about this Iranian achievement. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year, is operational and has acquired its debut images. "We have been waiting for this moment for so long," says INO Project Director Habib Khosrow Shahi, an astronomer at the Institute for Research in Fundamental Sciences, IPM, in Tehran. First light for the $25 million observatory comes at a turbulent time, Khosrow Shahi acknowledges. INO's scientific odyssey began 2 decades ago and faced long odds. When they started this project, it was just a dream. No one in Iran had attempted anything on this scale before, says Jerry Gilmore, an astronomer at the University of Cambridge and chair of INO's International Advisory Board. Last year, some former INO personnel voiced concerns about whether changes to INO's design might compromise its performance. Those doubts have been put to rest, says optical engineer Lorenzo Zago, a consultant and advisory board member. INO opened its Dome for Sky calibration on September 27th, and the next night imaged 282 ARP, a pair of galaxies some 319 million light-years from Earth. The image's resolution, 8/10 ARC seconds, and that of a second image taken a few days ago, 65/10 ARC seconds, are close to the limit set by atmospheric conditions at INO site, 3,600-meter Mount Gargash in central Iran. Gilmore says that resolution's spectacular, much better than expected. The science run, which hopefully starts next summer, will show the quality of the design and construction, says Reza Mansouri, a theoretical astrophysicist at the Sharif University of Technology who led the project until 2016 and who last year expressed worries about the telescope's future. Engineers still need to complete tasks such as integrating software, fine-tuning the active optics, and installing the first science instrument, a high-quality imaging camera. Initial science goals include probing galaxy formation evolution and stellar evolution and hunting for exoplanets. The Iranian Observatory and two others in the region, a 4-meter infrared telescope in Turkey nearing completion, and a 3.4-meter optical telescope in India fill a geographic gap in a global network that keys in on fleeting phenomena such as gamma-ray bursts to try to pinpoint their locations and unravel their physics. Gilmore says you need a chain of telescopes all around the world to follow up. In building INO, astronomers in Iran had to surmount hurdles that few colleagues elsewhere face, sanctions that curtail high-tech imports, and visa restrictions limiting their travel abroad. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm. INO engineers then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own. Zago says, "What surprises me is that the know-how came so fast. They have been working like hell. At every stage, they increased the project's ambition and complexity," Gilmore says. For example, he says, when so-called active control systems including sensors, actuators, and software that position a primary mirror first became available for larger telescopes about a decade ago, INO engineers incorporated those into design. What's truly astonishing, Zago says, is a precision vacuum chamber that INO engineers and an Iranian company fashioned to coat the blanks with aluminum, transforming the polished glass into telescope mirrors. When the United Kingdom in 2000 set out to build an aluminizing system for its visible and infrared survey telescope for astronomy, Gilmore says, it took us forever to get right. Khosrow Shahi hopes to forge partnerships with international teams that might install state-of-the-art instrumentation in INO's four instrument slots. He says, the door is open for our side, though sanctions and politics could stymie some potential collaborations. In the meantime, Iran's burgeoning astronomy community, just a couple of dozen strong, at the project's outset, but several hundred scientists and students today, Khosrow Shahi says, is looking forward to some serious stargazing. We fought with disappointment, darkness, and also with words that could discourage us, says IPM's Maryam Turki, adding, but in the end, we witnessed this glorious birth.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role models of faithfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that when we talk about the lifestyle, we must have someone to follow. There must be a role model. In the history, in the Islamic history, there must be some people or the leaders or the leading personalities must become the role model so that when we see them, we can follow them. And if we cannot follow them, if they cannot become the role model, then obviously we cannot apply the Islamic lifestyle in our daily life or in our life. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that, for example, in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about one of the role models in chapter 19, verse 54, he says, وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِسْمَعِيلَ إِنَّهُ كَانَ صَادِقَ الْوَعَدِ. He says that, remember, in the book, the prophet Ismail, that he was one of the truthful ones who used to fulfill his promise, his covenant with the others. Now, when we refer to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about this verse, he said that one day, Hazrat Ismail, the prophet Ismail, he made a promise to see someone at a specific place, out of city. So he went there and he was waiting for the person, but the other person forgot to come to the place and see Hazrat Ismail, the Prophet Ismail. And therefore he waited there until the companions of the Prophet Ismail, they got worried that why the Prophet is not coming back. Therefore one person went there and he asked him that, why you're not coming? We are worried about your absence. He said, I made a promise to that person to see him here, but he hasn't come yet. Therefore, his companions went after the person. They found him and they brought him to the Prophet. And he said, oh, Prophet, I apologize because I forgot that I have a commitment to see you at this place. And the Prophet Ismail said, even if you were not coming, I was waiting until you come. And since you came, now I can leave. So this is what the Prophet's personalities teaches us. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle, and we gave the example of Prophet Ismail. Similarly, when we look at the life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we see that even a day the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he has made a promise to see someone at a specific place. And that place, when the sun rays, obviously there was a hot weather and it was too hot. So companions of the Prophet has said to him to go to the shadow. And he refused. He said, because since I have made the promise to see him at this place, I will wait until he comes. So these things shows us that how the Prophets, when they used to make a promise to someone, how they used to be faithful to that. And obviously, when they are at the position of a teacher, they're basically teaching us, they're telling us that no matter when you made a promise, whether it's a hot weather, whether it's a cold weather, whatever it is, you must fulfill the promise, because the important thing is to fulfilling the promise. The important thing is to fulfill the covenant and be faithful to what you have said, so that your tongue, your speech has a value amongst the people. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful. On the other hand, we have the example of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth Imam, where he took some loan from someone, and as a security, he gave him a piece of thread. So when the time came when he wanted to give back the money, he went to the person and he asked him to give back the thread, a piece of thread. He said that it was nothing, it had no value, so I lost it. But Imam said, until you don't bring it, I will not give you back the money. So when he found it, he brought it, Imam said that, look, this piece of thread is of no value, but when it has become a security, and we promise that you will give me back this piece of thread and I will give you the money back, then obviously it has a value. Why? Because it is the part of the covenant that we have made, the promise that we have made. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful to the promise and covenant that we make, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.